This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Pip Williams was born in London, grew up in Sydney, and now calls the Adelaide Hills home. She's co-author of the book Time Bomb, Work, Rest and Play in Australia Today, and wrote One Italian Summer, a memoir of her family's travels in search of a good life. Pip has also published travel articles, book reviews, flash fiction and poetry. The Dictionary of Lost Words is her first novel.
So Pip, let's start at the very beginning. Did you always want to be a writer?
Yes, I did. Though, you know, I think like lots of kids, you don't think of it that way. You don't say, I want to be a writer. You just do stuff. You know, you are creative because you're a child and you do creative things, and you might be drawn to drawing or music or dance. And I was drawn to writing, even though I couldn't do it very well because I'm dyslexic. So I actually had trouble with words and writing, but, you know, it didn't bother me and it didn't bother my parents, and so it wasn't a big deal. But, yeah, most of what I wrote as a child in, say, primary school would have been possibly difficult to read and illegible. But, you know, I grew up in the 70s. I was a child. I was born in, you know, at the end of the 60s and grew up in the 70s. And it was this, the way you brought up children was just to tell them that absolutely everything they did was wonderful and amazing. And so that's what my parents did, regardless of the actual value of what I did. So, yeah, so it was probably an odd thing to be drawn to, given I had obvious issues with it, but it was the thing I was drawn to. And it was the way I expressed myself. And because it was just for me, it didn't matter at all how it actually came out on the page. Yeah, but then as you grow older, you know, you become an older teenager. It never actually occurred to me until I was about 15 that writing was something I could do for someone else. It was always just for me. But when I was 15, I published a poem in Dolly magazine. It's my very first publication.
Oh, how fantastic.
I know. And I'm still probably more proud of that than anything I've ever published. And it was imaginatively called 15. And it was all about
fabulous
being 15. And as you do when you're 15, you know, I wrote it from a very personal place. Basically, my parents had said I couldn't go out to a party. And so I'd locked myself in my room and written a poem.
This just gets better and better.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's fantastic. That's what, in a way, that's what writing for a young, for a child and adolescent, I think, is all about. It's about expressing yourself. And I felt hard done by my parents, and my way of expressing it was to write them a poem, wondering basically, you know, am I an adult or child, which was what the whole poem was about. And of course,
you can see why they published it.
Yeah. And Dad goes, well, this is quite a good poem. Why don't you send it off? So I sent it to Dolly magazine and they published it, and it was, you know, extraordinary. And that was the first and last thing I published for about, you know, 30 years.
I feel sorry for tweens and teens now. Dolly magazine was such a, like, it offered, I mean, maybe problematic in some ways, but it's a real thing people remember, isn't it?
Yeah,
as poetry and Dolly Doctor. And
Yeah. I think it was called Poet's Corner, and it was fantastic. Yeah, I loved Dolly magazine, and I was devastated when it folded. And it wasn't that long ago, really. It was only a few years ago that it folded. But it was, yeah, it's a sort of passing of something, of a time in history.
And have you still got the poem?
I do. I do.
Printout.
Yeah, yeah. And I embarrassingly, I was invited to the Bendigo Writers Festival, and they said, bring some early writing. And I thought, oh, and they said anything, you know, it could be a diary extract or anything. And I read some of my diary entries from that time, and they were so humiliating. There's no way on earth I was going to read anything from them. So I read this poem, yeah, which was kind of also slightly humiliating, but there we go. My mum had it, of course. Yeah, I didn't have it. My mum had it. I had to say, Mum, you know, did you by any chance keep? Oh, of course I kept it. I kept everything.
And could find it. That's impressive too.
Oh, yeah. She's quite an organised person.
So you had a little bit of a break from publication post-Dolly.
Yeah.
You went on to write nonfiction, a travel memoir, and then The Dictionary of Lost Words came out. It is your first novel, massively successful. Listeners may or may not be aware that it's sold about a billion copies.
Oh, yeah. That's an exact figure, I think. Give or take one or two books. Yeah, a billion is about right. Don't know.
So where and how did the writing of it begin?
I always wanted to write fiction. I think I'm one of those... I'm one of those women, and we do tend to be women, who I don't do anything until I know I'm capable of doing it, if that makes sense. You know, I don't apply for jobs I'm not 100% qualified to do. And so I had always wanted to write fiction, but I felt like I used to be an academic and I'd written a lot of academic stuff. And I felt like I needed a bit of an apprenticeship in creative writing, because academic writing is an antithesis to being creative in a way. There's so many sort of formulas to writing academic papers and books and stuff, that I had to unlearn how to do that. And we did this amazing family kind of trip slash experience, which was being willing workers on organic farms around Italy. So we took the kids out of school and quit our jobs, actually, and it was a bit of a midlife crisis, to be fair, and went to Italy for about 6 months. And then when we came back, I was as depressed as I was when we left because we were back, and nothing seemed to have changed. And Shannon said, "Why don't you write about it?" He knew that I'd always wanted to write, and he sort of said, "We've got, you know, you're unemployed now. You've got, you know, we've spent all our money. You're unemployed. While you're looking for a job, why don't you start writing about this experience?" And so I did, and I thought about it in a way as an apprenticeship for creative writing, because even though I wanted to write fiction, I also knew that I needed to kind of learn how to write fiction, and that writing creative nonfiction was a nice stepping stone towards that. A lot of the skills, a lot of the craft is the same. And also telling a story that meant so much to me and my family felt like there was no pressure for this to be published. You know, that if it was never published, it would still have value to us. And that is what kept me writing when I thought, you know, this isn't going to go anywhere. But it did keep me writing, and that was a really good exercise, not just in learning the craft of creative writing, but learning the discipline of creative writing, you know, learning to that you just have to turn up. And for me, not wait for the muse, not wait for inspiration, just start writing and inspiration will come in a way. And just learning all of that, learning a bit about yourself as a writer. You know, there were a lot of trial and error in terms of how I write and what circumstances I need to write in. And what I just said, you know, that I realised that I actually can't just wait for an idea to happen or else I wouldn't write a word. The ideas happen as I'm writing. And so that was a really good lesson to learn, that so I just needed to start writing. And when that was published, it opened a door, really, because first of all, it meant that I obviously have managed to learn how to write creatively well enough because someone published it. But from a really practical point of view, it meant I now had a relationship with a publisher. Mm. So anything I wrote after that wouldn't have to sit on a slush pile. I could take it straight to a publisher and get their opinion, their honest opinion about it. If I wanted, I could get advice. Not that I did that, actually. I sort of wrote it in secret. My publisher didn't even know I was writing it, The Dictionary of Lost Words, that is.
So how did the start? How did you start to write it?
Yeah, you asked that question and then I completely avoided answering it.
No. I think it's a great leading to writing fiction. I guess I'm interested as well in The Dictionary of Lost Words, because to me it feels like such a conceptual thing to understand. I think I had heard you say somewhere else that the social researcher in you identified that the way there was like an error in the methodology of putting words together.
Exactly.
And so certain words were omitted, which is a beautiful concept, but the translation of that to story, that's a huge leap, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually the way I came to it is I read a book by Simon Winchester, which a lot of people have read, called The Surgeon of Crowthorne, which is a really pithy little nonfiction story of a relationship between James Murray, who is the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, and one of the more prolific volunteers who sent in words with example sentences showing how they'd been used in literature. And it's those little slips of paper with those sentences that the lexicographers use to define words. And it was such a fascinating story. But by the end of it, the thing that stuck with me for such a long time, I couldn't get it out of my head, was the methodology of creating the Oxford English Dictionary, because it was a Victorian era project. It was started in 1858, finished in 1928. And a word could only be included in the dictionary if it had a textual history. And the thing that bothered me was that the data they were using, even though they had actually a really quite, you know, relatively scientific criteria for what words should and shouldn't be included and so on, at its core, the data or the words had to have been written down. And at that time in history, there was a huge proportion of the population were illiterate and weren't even capable of writing their language down. The people who had access to writing books, whether it was literature or scientific textbooks or manuals or whatever it was, labels on medicine bottles, because even that kind of text was used as examples for how words were used. Most of the people writing those words were men. And it just made me think this is a really gendered project because their data set is biased. It's biased not just towards men, but it's biased also towards educated men. And at that time, that meant middle class and upper class men. So it was a very, a really biased project. And that interested me as a researcher. That idea interested me. And it wasn't until I'd started writing another novel, something I thought was much more manageable for me as a first-time novelist. I was 20,000 words into it, and this idea about the dictionary just kept bothering me. It wouldn't let me go. So while I was writing this other thing, I just kept getting ideas for how I could explore this question about whether it matters that the dictionary was written by men from sources that were written by men, whether it mattered or not. And I started to get an idea for how I could explore that in fiction. And the idea was simply to put a girl into the scriptorium where all of the words for the English language were being defined, and then follow her journey, if you like, into adulthood, into womanhood, in relationship to that place, that scriptorium. So I wanted to see how would the words that are floating around, literally sometimes floating around the scriptorium, that her father and other lexicographers are defining, how do those words impact her? And how could she, as a girl growing into a woman, impact the words? And that was it, really. And so the first scene really is this little girl under the sorting table, and a word falls in her lap, and immediately she has a reaction to that word. Her reaction is just to keep it. You know, she wants to keep that word for herself. And she collects it and then starts to collect more. And then the words become something that she refers to when she has questions about her life. And sometimes they satisfy those questions, but other times they let her down. And that's where it started.
So it's a fascinating thing. I wondered, in terms of research, the book talks about these little slips a lot. Have you seen the slips? Have you been?
Yes, I have. I was so lucky. I had two research trips to Oxford, and I was given full access to the Oxford English Dictionary archives. And they were so generous and so helpful. The archivist there was a young woman, and her name's Beverly McCulloch. And before I left Australia, she said, send me a list of everything you want to know about the dictionary, or send me a list of words that you want to look at, or types of words you want to look at, because we still have boxes and boxes and boxes of the slips. But there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these, thousands of these boxes. So if you tell me the words you're interested in, I'll find all those slips in the archives. I just sent her a list of, I'm interested in all the words around the suffragette movement or the suffrage movement. I'm interested in some words I knew had been left out of the dictionary, like cunt, for instance, had been excluded, even though it ticked every single criteria for inclusion. So that's one of those words that was excluded because the men who were defining it, James Murray in particular for this word, and it was unusual for him because he usually wasn't swayed by that argument of a word being vulgar and therefore not worthy of being in this dictionary that they were putting together. But in this case, he was the one that decided the word shouldn't go in, even though it fitted all his criteria. And that's just an example, you know, of I suppose how we think of a dictionary as such an objective thing, but all along the way, subjectivity is coming into play in terms of what words the rest of us should be getting an understanding of. Because by leaving a word out, they're saying, no, you're not allowed to understand that word. And Kant in particular is interesting because it's an extremely old English word, one of the oldest, in fact, that is still in use, that has been written down. It was written down by Chaucer, famously, so he used it in his literature. But he didn't use it as an insult the way we might use it today. He used it as a euphemism for a woman's body part, you know, for it's a euphemism for vagina. And there's nothing wrong with that. But the word has changed. It's had its own kind of character arc over the centuries. And when they were defining it in, and this was pre-20th century, so C was being worked on in the 1890s, when they were defining it, it was very vulgar, but it hadn't always been so. And even if it was, that shouldn't have been a reason to exclude it. But what they were excluding isn't just the meaning at that time, they were excluding how that word had evolved. And, you know, in so many ways, it was a, you know, a terrible thing to omit it. And anyway, so I knew some words had been omitted. And so I wanted to see the slips that would have been sent in for these words. And so they could get me all those slips as well. So I have, you know, I had access to words that were included, but also words that were excluded. But I could see how they had been used in literature throughout, you know, throughout the century sometimes. And also some were very, very recent. So the word suffragette was only coined in 1906. And it's also a fascinating word with its own character, you know, story arc, because it originally was an insult. It was coined by newspaper men, shock jocks really of their day, to put down the women who had started to become militant within the women's suffrage movement, particularly the women of Emmeline Pankhurst's WSPU, who had made it, you know, made a decision to break the law essentially in order to get attention for the rights of women to vote. And they were termed suffragettes to separate them from the more mature women, the suffragists, who were speaking up and marching perhaps, but they weren't breaking the law. They weren't putting anyone out with their activities. And so they were essentially saying, you know, these little girls are acting up. And when I say little girls, I use it on purpose because the et on the word of suffrage means smaller than. It's a diminutive, which is why the word was an insult and why it was coined. But what happened with that word was that the Emmeline Pankhurst appropriated it a few years later and called her journal the suffragette. And all of a sudden that word had a different meaning because it was used very differently and women rallied under it. It became a banner. And today when we talk about the suffrage movement, we actually often talk about the suffragette movement, which isn't entirely correct, but that's how ubiquitous that word has become. And it gives a sense of how the meaning of that word changed so dramatically from being an insult to being, you know, a label of value to the women who were who it was used against.
It is fascinating the way in which the study of words and of the dictionary tells you about the world in which they exist and evolve. Presumably when the dictionary was created, people may not have conceived of women even contributing to it, like such was the kind of role that women had. As someone writing now in the modern day, how do you balance modern sensibilities with the truth of the past or trying to capture the past?
I love this question. I think it's a really important question because I think we're guilty a little bit of romanticising the past and assuming that people were very, very different to us. So every now and then, it hasn't happened very much, but every now and then someone will criticise my book or another book that's historical fiction for imposing sensibilities of the present on people or characters of the past. And this is particularly around women's roles, maybe the way women might speak or speak out, the things they might talk about, the things they might do, the fact that they might have sex outside marriage, et cetera, et cetera. My response to that is that usually, you know, there's a difference between imposing, say, modern language, modern ways of expressing yourself, perhaps some modern ideas on the past. But I think when we say that's not true to the way women were in the past, we have to be very careful that we're not buying into the stereotypes that a lot of male literature has given us. And the example that I use is that we wouldn't have the vote unless women thought the way we think now, because women were fighting to be heard. They were fighting for equal rights. They were fighting for equality in so many domains, whether that's work, in the home, in the bedroom. If they weren't, we wouldn't be voting at the next election. And so sometimes I think we forget that women of the past had to fight as hard or harder than us for these rights that we now take for granted and that we now say are modern sensibilities. They're not. Women have been fighting throughout history for the things we are still fighting for. They've done it in different ways. They've done it, you know, in keeping with the language and, you know, dress codes of their time. But women went to jail and on hunger strike for some of the things that we are still talking about today. You know, they weren't, they weren't delicate creatures. And it's a mistake for us to think that they were. And a mistake for us to think that when we talk about some of the things that concern us today, that they did not concern women 100 years ago. They did.
That's a great answer. And I think probably that's the nuance that's lost too, isn't it? If you are unable to contribute to the writing of history, then part of the betrayal.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, there's a lot of historical fiction where people might be offended, say, by the sexuality that might be portrayed in an historical fiction book, and yet forget about the number of women who died in backyard abortion houses. Now, they wouldn't have been there unless they were having sex outside the conventions of the time. Do you know what I mean? These things, you know, as we know, prostitution is the oldest occupation in the, you know, in the world, in history, and yet we still think that we're imposing, say, the liberal behaviours and ideas of the 21st century if we're talking about women being sexually free in some historical period. There's another really interesting thing which we forget, but the Edwardians were, you know, considered, it was an era of modernism. So just post Queen Victoria, the Edwardians had a reputation for rejecting Victorian values, and actually middle class Edwardians in particular, if you read some of the literature but also some of the magazines of the time, this idea of a much freer, much more diverse attitudes towards sexuality and all of those sorts of things are really rife at that time. And yet we've forgotten that. So when we're writing about early 20th century, I think a lot of readers still think that we should be writing about a time that was much more prim and proper. It actually was changing. It was a very dynamic time, and ideas about sexuality and marriage and partnering up and the vote and all those things were extremely present at that time.
It's almost a bit of the social researcher again with that, you know, what sources you look for that contradict other narratives. One of the things that I think is incredible about the Dictionary of Lost Words is that for a story that is set predominantly in England in the late 1800s, early 1900s, I walked away thinking about the loss of Aboriginal language and words in Australia. And that's largely, that is due to the epigraph of the book. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you thought about when you decided to include that epigraph?
Yeah, it was important for me because this, in a way, writing this book was actually a way for me personally to answer a few questions. It was a way of exploring, whether language is gendered. That's where it started. But it didn't finish there. As I was writing the book, I couldn't help but then, I suppose, consider how what I was exploring could be extended to other questions. And, of course, the other questions are, is there a gendered issue with the dictionary? Is there a class issue with the dictionary? So, you know, the language of the middle and upper class of England is quite different to the language of the lower classes. And for the Oxford English Dictionary in particular, slang was excluded on the whole from the dictionary. And yet slang, we call it slang as if it's lesser than the proper words. But in fact, slang is often a way that the working class or people from different districts or whatever people from different occupations, slang is slang words are words that express something slightly better than the word that they've been given, if that makes sense. And so they're very valid words because they explain something better than the proper word. And one of those words is knackered, which is in the book. It's not in the Oxford English Dictionary, but I'm almost certain it would have been used because I know it was used by my grandmother and I can only assume it's been used through the ages to some extent. But middle class and upper class people would never feel knackered. They'd never get that feeling of being worn out like an old horse that's no longer any use. Do you know what I mean? The tiredness they might feel from their daily activities doesn't equate to the exhaustion that someone who gets up before dawn and goes to bed, you know, when everyone else in the household has gone to bed. It doesn't equate to that exhaustion. It doesn't equate to the exhaustion of people who work in mines and kitchens and tanneries. And so I think that word knackered is just a nice sort of, it's just an example of a word that might be very important and useful and much more explanatory than the word tired or listless or exhausted even. It has real meaning, and yet it was left out of the dictionary. And so as I wrote this book, I just started to think about how important it was for a society to understand the language of everybody who lives in that society. And if you don't understand that language, it's difficult for people to then express themselves in a way where they're fully understood. And so, of course, I then thought about First Nations people in Australia, because that's where I'm from, but also around the world. If you take language away from people, you're taking away their history, you're taking away their culture, you're invalidating their experience because they can no longer explain it properly to you. And that's what we did in Australia. We largely took language away from First Nations people. And I wanted the book to do for a reader what it was doing for me. And it was, I suppose, the themes I was exploring them because they're relevant today to me, that idea of gendered language. And I couldn't really finish the book without acknowledging that the loss of Indigenous languages around the world, and in Australia in particular, was a tragedy because it meant that you can't have full reconciliation unless you can understand somebody properly. And if you take language away from, say, the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains, which is, so their language was taken away in one major respect. They didn't speak it, you know, they weren't to speak it, they weren't taught it, etc. And so over generations it was lost. But what did happen is some German missionaries, when they came to Adelaide, they spent time writing down as much of the language as they could in collaboration with some of the elders of the Kaurna people who lived on the Adelaide Plains at the time. And those words were rescued to some extent, so that when Kaurna people decided they wanted to, were given access to reclaiming their language, they did have something to work with. So there would have been some memory, but actually a lot had been lost. And the Kaurna language, like many other languages, is now being built up again, if that makes sense. And there's just like whenever a language is lost, there's some disagreement, I think, sometimes about how a word should be said or spelt or whatever. But what's positive is that this language is now being revived, and it's something that we can all learn from. And by learning some Kaurna language, what you're learning isn't just a new way of saying something, but you're learning a little bit about the culture of the people who came, who were here before us. You're learning a little bit about, you know, what is important to them historically, but also in the present. And that's, I think, an act of reconciliation, is learning another's language.
It is a lovely note that the book ends on. It really, I think it absolutely has that intended effect of making something that could be very white and very historic and very, you know, ye olde in England, it gives it currency in the present day. Pip, once the manuscript was finished, what happened? How did it, you mentioned that you had previously had a book published. You had a publisher, but not necessarily a publisher of this book. What did you do?
So, like I said, I kind of wrote it in secret. I didn't want to show any of it to anyone really until I'd finished a draft. You know, I'd written a travel memoir, which is a relatively light thing, I suppose, in the publishing world. And writing, you know, what I think is a more weighty historical fiction probably isn't the expectation for someone who's written travel memoir. And so there was no expectation, no pressure that I should, you know, move on to writing historical fiction. And so there was enormous freedom, really, in writing this novel in private and just for myself. I found it a joyous experience. And I did have a mentor for about 6 months. So Tony Jordan, I actually got in touch with the Australian Mentors Program, which Catherine Heyman sort of set up a long time ago. And she connects really experienced writers with people who want to write better or have a mentor during a project. And because I have never gone to, I haven't studied writing. And so I really value that mentor relationship. I really value what I get from not collaborating so much, but just working with someone who knows what they're doing. So I always have doubted whether what I'm doing is any good in a way, simply because I haven't got any reference. I haven't had teachers. And so mentors to me are really important. So through that program, I hooked up with Toni Jordan she's from Melbourne as well, a wonderful writer.
And an amazing writer.
Amazing writer and an amazing mentor and teacher of writing. And I knew this about her, and so I was really keen to work with her. And so she worked with me for about 6 months or so while I'd probably written about half the first draft, and she worked with me, towards that second half. And she had a word to my publisher, essentially, and said to my publisher, you better get in touch with Pip and ask for her manuscript, because I hadn't shown to him. So he did.
Yeah.
And I said, he did, bless him. This is Martin Hughes from Affirm Press. So, Pip, you know, are you going to send us this manuscript? And I essentially said, no, I'm not ready. I just want to finish it and then I'll send it. I just essentially didn't want any feedback. I didn't want anyone saying, oh, perhaps it should end like this or end like that. I felt like I needed to see it through. It just needed to be me and Esme, essentially, right up until the end. And I didn't want the pressure or the expectation, yeah, I suppose, of anybody else. And even though I thought, oh, maybe I really should, you know, because it didn't have a publisher, you know, it wasn't like I had a contract with anybody or an advance or anything like that. It was just, and I felt like maybe I'm being a real idiot here. You know, someone's asked to see my writing and I'm saying no. And it was such a different experience to, you know, the first time round where I'm sending it to absolutely, you know, the memoir I sent to absolutely everybody, yes, I possibly could, and was desperate for somebody to read it. And this time I just felt so protective of it. And I think probably more I was protective of that sense of freedom that I could write whatever I wanted to write. But when I'd finished, really interestingly, I went to Varuna, the writer's house in the Blue Mountains in Sydney, and I was at Varuna, and I think Toni Jordan had another word with Martin, just saying, have you read Pip's manuscript yet? And he said, no, she won't let me. And I think Toni just said, oh, just hassle her until she gives it to you or something like that. And he got in touch. Literally, it was the day I'd finished the last scene.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and so it was good timing, really, because I was so elated. You know, I'd sort of, it wasn't obviously, there was redrafting to do and all that sort of stuff. But for me, the story was done. I knew.
Did it feel polished? Like, was it?
No, I mean, the way I write, my first draft is usually, you know, the first draft of this was about 130,000 words. So I write more than less. It's not like an outline or anything like that. It's a fully fleshed out draft manuscript. And I also polish as I go. So, yeah. Well, of course, it wasn't a polished draft. Every chapter, every scene was as written as well as I could write it, if that makes sense. And so for me, the redrafting is more about, there's a lot of structural work. It's about, you know, what scenes should stay and what scenes can be left out, because I've always written too much. So it's that kind of editing. But I do write every scene as well as I possibly can. So I will write and rewrite three or four times as I go. I don't redraft or anything, but I always read it and then tweak it until it reads as well as I think it possibly can. And then, of course, it gets to an editor and they they make it pretty clear that it can read a lot better.
And so, I'm always interested in that, though, how early people send things. So you sent it, obviously, from Varuna.
I sent it.
And the response was...
Yeah, and it was well, actually what I did, at first what I did is send him some sample chapters. I didn't send him the whole manuscript, but I was ready for him to consider it, if that makes sense. So up until this point, he had no idea what it was, you know, he had no idea about it other than vaguely that it was about the Oxford English Dictionary. So I sent him a sort of summary and then about 10,000 words, the first few chapters. And he loved what he read, I suppose. And then we chatted and I sent him the rest. So it was fantastic. It was just really exciting. I think I always knew that the idea was good. And my biggest fear while I was writing it, and this might be why I didn't want to show it to anybody, I thought the idea was so good in terms of having, you know, this idea that something we've all got on our shelves, like dictionaries, a bit like encyclopedias, mm-hmm. we look at them and we never question their authority. And suddenly I was questioning the authority of a dictionary, and I just sort of thought, you know, it's just in plain sight. This idea is sitting in plain sight. And so as an idea, I knew that as soon as the idea was put into the heads of anybody else, they would realise, of course. So in that sense, I knew the idea was good, and my biggest fear was letting it down. My biggest fear was that I had this opportunity to write this book, this bit of fiction, and to explore this idea, and I could make a real hatchet job of it and ruin the idea in a way. Do you know what I mean? Because it was worth doing well, and I wasn't sure I could do it well enough. And I think that's why I was reluctant to show anybody, you know, the story until I felt like I at least was comfortable with how I'd dealt with it. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a funny thing, though. You know, I kind of felt like, and Toni Jordan said this to me as well. So she loved the idea, and she said to me, one of the first things she said was, I wish this was your fourth novel, because it was that idea that, you know, this is a weighty, this is kind of an important subject. And you know, and this is exactly what I thought, you might not be ready to write about it because I'd never written fiction.
Mm.
Yeah, but by the end of it, I was confident. She was fine because she was hassling my publisher.
That's right, exactly. It paid off.
Yeah.
So the book also went on to spark an international bidding war.
I love how people say that
from the newsletter.
I know. I'm sure it was a bidding war.
I also just love the application of battle language in the arts realm.
Yeah.
Like it's lovely.
Now that striking forth with our pens.
Exactly. So what was that like for you?
Oh, it was so bizarre because, of course, I was working. I had a day job. I have been lucky enough to give up my day job in the last 12 months, but I had a day job. And so Martin, my publisher, would be ringing, you know, in the middle of the day, and I was working as a social planner, so doing all sorts of things, often doing community consultation around various projects, government projects. And I was doing this big consultation for a national park in South Australia, and we had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people come to this national, you know, what would be a national park, and we're asking them how it should be designed and blah, 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 you know, all of the facilities. And I had an Ask Me T-shirt on, and all of a sudden I'm getting phone calls from Martin saying, now an English publisher has you know put in an offer, and I've got people coming up and asking me stuff, and I'm sort of trying to absorb what he's telling me while at the same time showing someone how to fill out a survey about the amenities that they might want, you know, in the national park. And it was just so surreal, this sort of balancing of kind of some, you know, a writer's absolute dream. And in fact, I never dreamt of it because it was too big. That's too big a dream for me. And so I hadn't actually considered anything like that. And then still doing my day job, you know, still turning up and doing the stuff that you have to do, because in fact, that's the reality as well, because even though all these, you know, various offers were coming in, the payoff is still in the future, if that makes sense. So it's not like you can, it's not like, you know, winning the lottery, really. It's not like you can stop doing what you're doing. And it's not like I wanted to either. It's kind of, I think for me particularly, I like kind of the everyday of living. Mm. And I'm not sure getting too carried away with the potential of all these, you know, different offers from overseas publishers and things would have done me any good whatsoever. Mm. Yeah. And I, you know, the way I've approached it really is as a job, as a new job, and it has certain requirements just like my old job did. And I try to do it as professionally as I can. You know, it's there's a creative part to my job, my new job, which is the time I spend in cafes writing the new book, and because I write in cafes, and the time I, you know, put my feet up on the couch and read something that's related or not to the new book. But then there is a lot of pragmatic kind of administrative work associated with the dictionary in particular, that I just treat like a job. I turn up, I try to be responsible, I try to be polite, all those things.
But yeah, well, you're doing a very good job of it. Very polite. One of the things that people often consider as part of the job is social media. You are not on social media, and I'm very curious about this. Obviously, it's a conscious decision.
Sort of.
What was the thinking?
There was no
thinking. Only sort of.
Yeah, I've never been on social media. So in a way, there was no conscious decision. Mm. So before I published anything, I wasn't on social media. And before I published the memoir, One Italian Summer, everyone was telling me you need to have a social media presence or no one will publish you. It doesn't come naturally to me, the social media thing. I'm not overly interested in posting about myself. Like, well, not overly interested. I'm completely disinterested in telling anybody about my day in any way. And I guess I've always sort of felt like, and I still feel this way, I can't understand why anyone would be interested in what I have to say. And I know that might sound really silly, but it's still how I sort of feel, that I'm not sure that I could articulate myself in any way that would add value to social media or to other people's life. And so I'm an introvert. I'm not a huge sharer, which sounds really silly when you then find out I wrote a whole book about myself. But in a way, yeah, I kind of found that easier. And in a way, I don't think I could have written that book, like I said, if it wasn't of value to my family, but also if some of the themes in that book weren't current to other people's lives. Mm. So it's a lot about kind of pursuing a dream and work and all that sort of stuff. And I hoped that it would be relevant to other people, that it wasn't, you know, I was using myself as an example in some ways. And then when that book got published, that kind of meant that I can get a book published without being on social media. And then when the dictionary, and I always said to my publisher, if you want me to be on social media, I will be on social media. I wasn't against it, and I would have done it for the job, but they never asked me to. And now that the dictionary's been published, I actually am really glad I never went on social media. And I think it's because it is much bigger than I thought it would be. And I know from friends who've published books who are quite active on social media, they get so many wonderful messages, and their anxiety is about, you know, replying to everything. And if you're on social media, there's an expectation that you are aware of all of that wonderful feedback that's coming through on social media. And I know from my friends' experience that they sometimes can spend, you know, they can spend half a day on social media doing the right thing and responding to people's good wishes. And it becomes such an onerous task that they have no time to write. Mm. So in that way, I'm kind of glad I'm not on social media, because it's harder to get in touch with me, but it's not impossible to get in touch with me. I do actually have a website, which I did set up before finishing the manuscript for Dictionary of Lost Words. I set up a website just so that when I, you know, because I didn't know whether my publisher would want it. So if I needed to shop it around, people could actually get a bit of a feel for who I was. But a website's very different because it's not interactive. It's not a daily thing. But it does have a place where you can email me if you need to. So it seems to have worked out really well, because so I'm not inundated. And because I do like to respond to everybody who gets in touch, because I feel incredibly grateful that they've read the book, but even more grateful that they've taken the time out of their day, first of all, to find me, because it's, you know, it is hard to find me on find a way to contact me. But second of all, to sort of tell me what they think. I just think that's it's such a generous thing to sort of tell a writer that what you've done has touched them in some way. Very humbling.
It's very humbling. That is a lovely note to end on. Thank you so very, very much for your time and your wisdom today, Pip. It's been wonderful.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.